You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
When I first arrived in South Africa, that's going back 25 years or so, so I must have been about 3 at the time, the concept of a celebrity chef was not really there. There were a couple of international food type stars, but in South Africa, there were certainly some very good cooks and good chefs, but that idea of being a celebrity chef wasn't really in play. Well, this week on The Dan Nichols Show, we meet somebody who's very much at the pinnacle of that celebrity chef space, not just because he's enormously cool and square-jawed and chiseled and good-looking, but also because he oversees some of the finest restaurants in the country, not just one of the few that sits in the world's 100 best for South Africa, but also the one we find ourselves at today, Aram, his brand new establishment out at Boschendal. From that, you can work out, plus the good looking bit, that it must be Peter Tempelhof, to whom I say a very warm welcome.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure to have you here.
I'm really excited.
Nice to be on the show.
Because I remember you telling me this. I remember Paul Bruce Brand, your concierge, telling me about this as well, as the concept kind of took shape that this was somewhere you were going to create. And now we find ourselves at this beautiful new home of Peter Tempelhof.
It's a peach, isn't it? It's turned out really well. It's actually beyond my expectations. We kind of didn't envisage the final product to look like this, but yeah, we're extremely happy with it. It's actually turned out more like an art installation or like a museum because of the building, because it's such a heritage building. We couldn't put the nails in the walls and anything on the floor. We just had to install things. So yeah, but... yeah, and the food's not too bad either.
I'm actually having lunch here today, which I'm very excited about. I'll come back to the restaurant towards the end because I want to go back to the build-up of this story.
Yeah, of course.
And to start with Peter Tempelhof finding himself into the way of food, because at some point, as children growing up, our parents get sick and tired of making our school sandwiches and packing our lunches, and we have to start finding our own way around the kitchen. In my case, it normally involved a weekly call to the fire brigade, but there are some for whom this is a more natural transition than others. When did Peter Tempelhof's interest in food juxtapose with, hang on, I'm actually quite good at this?
Well, that came when I was about 26. I used to love cooking from probably 4 or 5 with my dad and my mom. Mom was a terrible cook. She needed help in the kitchen. So I used to chuck a handful of olives over my shoulder into her pot and some herbs here and there and chop a handful of bacon into something. And, you know, rest her soul. She didn't teach me a lot about food, but along the way, I just picked up, you know, from my waitering jobs and helping her a little bit in the kitchen just to get her meals along the way. I mean, her idea of meal was a dinner for us kids was, let's have fish tonight, pull the hake out of the oven, out of the freezer, sorry, put it on a tray, put it in the oven, then turn the oven on. So that
this is
so she taught me a lot of how not to do things, but she had some great recipes that she brought back from Canada. I think it's also my dad used to get stuck in as well. He used to make jams from our tree when we were living in Joburg and make ice cream the old-fashioned way with a hand cranker and the salt rock in the ice. So I had a lot of good memories. My grandmother, she's very Afrikaans. She had a farm in Delmas. And I just remember her Sunday feasts, roast lamb and, you know, the beans and potatoes, briedi, like cooked down with the lamb juices and white pepper. It's incredible Afrikaans food. So I've got a good mix of, Canadian and, well, not the Canadian has a food culture, but Canadian cool recipes and Afrikaans recipes. So that's how I grew up,
26, though, is a little far down the road where most people, not most, but a lot of chefs are already in a kitchen of some sort in their late teens, early 20s. So what was the journey up to 26?
Yeah, so I'd done a lot of other things. Dan, I'd, did university, did economics, got halfway through it. I said, no, this isn't for me. I do not want to be an economist. Do not want to be a sociologist as well. And I decided to, I needed to work with my hands more. So I went overseas. I was doing a finished carpentry job in Texas for a bit. And then I worked my way through to LA, did some work, similar building work, construction in LA. And then I came back to South Africa and I started a tree felling business. I was cutting as a lumberjack in Durban for a little bit.
The natural platform for a career in restaurants. Yeah.
And I'd always worked in restaurants to make extra cash as a waiter or a bartender. And one of the standout places I worked in was actually in Dallas in the Petroleum Club, oil money, like on the 30th floor overlooking Dallas. Flipping tartare at the table side and Caesar salads. And I enjoyed that part of it. And it wasn't until I got back And I was, you know, pissing my life up against the wall. And my mom's best friend said to me, you need to do something. I can see you like to cook. There's a place that's opening in this very valley, the ICA. It's opening. It's the first year. They might have a couple of places left. And I called them and they had a space for me, one space left. And there was 12 of us that year. And I drove down in my little VW and I started, yeah, started the journey at 26. So
this stage, you've been working all sorts of different jobs. You've said, right, economist is not for me, and the other jobs that might have come with that. When you started this latest chapter, did you feel that this was finally it? Or was it, well, let's see what happens and what unfolds?
Yeah, I think the penny dropped when I was eating a meal cooked by Raymond Blanc. He'd come down to the Cape. He was with the Good Food and Wine Show. And he was cooking out of the Grand Roche where I was doing my internship. And I think at that stage, his dinner was like, I don't know, like 500 Rand or something for this big, that was in 96, 97. So 500 Rand was quite a bit. It was like 500 bucks for this, I think it was an 8-course meal.
That was the down payment on a house in Plumstead in those days.
Yeah, and I think it was after like the third course, it dawned on me that this is, wow, there's actually a proper career in this. And if I could make food like that one day, then I'd be a very happy man. And yeah, after that, just inspired me. And Raymond Blanc came out and we talked and yeah, I didn't really get to know well, but yeah, he was just an inspirational guy back then. And he still is now today. And yeah, then from there, I went to go work in London after Grand Roche. Grand Roche was kind of the best restaurant in Africa at the time. It was really gourmand. It was run by the late Frank Slomka, who was a two Michelin star German chef, actually. And he ran a tight ship. And when I went to London, I realized, shit, I've actually got quite good skills, you know, because I came from this really hard kitchen here and I went to go work in a Marco Pierre White's restaurants. And I could keep up with the guys, actually take over the guys, you know, a chef from Africa just out of kind of college a couple of years later. I worked my way up really fast to sous chef for Marco Pierre White, and I realized I didn't have enough international experience. So then I took a step back from sous chef. I went back to be a chef de party at another Michelin star restaurant for another 2 years. I worked for free for 4 months because they didn't have a position for me. That's how dedicated I was to learn more about it. And yeah.
It's such an important part of the chef story that we often miss, especially in the current world where the celebrity chef's got 4 television shows and 9 restaurants and drives Italian sports cars and their life just seems to be uber glamorous and fabulous.
Yeah.
And aside from the fact that it's not like that all the time, it also comes on the back of this extraordinary apprenticeship where you are peeling potatoes and you're washing dishes. And as you say, you're not getting paid for 4 months. There's a lot you have to go through that's not that much fun.
No, you get bollocked a lot, you burn yourself, your back is sore, you're constantly grumpy. It's not easy, you know. It still isn't easy, but, you know, at least we can manage the hours a bit better now. We've got some great people around me, and they can take a bit of the load off me, and, yeah, we can focus on being creative. But at that time in your life, it is a hard time to get through. But if you can get through it and you can learn as much as you can, then you can excel from there. So I really want to, you know, I try to all my chefs, do what you can to get some international experience, work as hard as you can, just be a sponge, absorb everything, absorb every blow that the chef gives you, absorb every hard service, and it'll make you a stronger chef. And that's what I try and instill in the guys, you know. Take my shit and smile.
There is that army boot camp feel to, I think, our perception of how kitchens work, where you have your Gordon Ramsay with the language of Wayne Rooney addressing a referee when he hasn't been given a decision. You see the slightly darker side, the Noma scandal and Remy, and there is that element where you wonder from the outside, yeah, how much of this is theater, how much of it is real, what was it like as a young chef, how tough, difficult was it, and how has that shaped your own approach and philosophy to running a kitchen?
Yeah, you know, when you're working in London, in those dark, underground, dingy kitchens, you don't see a lot of sun. And sun's important, I think, for your disposition. It's important for your mood. And I would get to work. I'd go to get on the underground. It would be dark because I'd get there like 8:30, 9 o'clock. It's still dark. And then you go downstairs. You work in the kitchen till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You come out, it's dark again. You just don't see the light for like 5-6 days a week. And I think this plays on everybody's mind there. So I found London kitchens particularly more brutal than when I worked in other parts of the world where there is a bit more sunshine. So I think that plays a bit of a part. I think Denmark is very similar. It's quite dreary. Yeah, the sun issues there. But it's played on my mind. When I got back, I had this London mentality in me where I was very brutal. I was throwing onions back at chefs and never smacking them and never like abusing them like that. But, you know, I was a lot of shouting, a lot of screaming, because also your adrenaline's worked up. There's a lot of pressure.
It's an emotional space.
It's an emotional space, yeah. So you don't know how you're going to behave, actually, when you're put into that situation. When I got back, I was particularly mean, you know, and it wasn't until a commis chef, I forget his name, but a commis chef literally said, "Chef, can I speak to you, please?" And it took incredible balls for this guy to do it. And he asked me to come into the fridge. And I said, "Yeah, what do you want?" And he's like, "Chef, everybody wants to leave. The whole kitchen's they're down. They're getting abused. Everyone wants to leave because of you." And I thought, well, I thought you guys are all fucking happy learning everything. And, you know, we're doing great. We just go into the top 10 restaurants in the country. And they're like, well, no, they all want to go. So like, okay, we have to do things differently here. You know, especially here in Franschhoek, that was a Grand Provence. It's hard to get staff in. So I'd end up training them. They get abused for a bit and they leave. And all that knowledge I imparted in them, they would go with them. So that was a turning moment for me in this, you know, in this country. I needed to make that shift. And yeah, it's admirable of the young chef to tell me that, because sometimes you don't see your own faults, you know, and I didn't see it. I just thought, hey, this is how we're going to do it. And this is my way or the highway. And it didn't quite work. And nowadays, I'm glad that happened to me 15 years ago, because nowadays it's very different. You know, it'd be hard for me to turn on a dime if I kept those bad habits in place all this time, especially with this Me Too and this Noma thing around now. You can't operate like that anymore.
It's a very courageous move from that young chef. And I'd imagine it was much anguish in the build-up to having this conversation. Yeah. But I think it also says a lot about you and your ability to, okay, well, I can understand that. And you could have simply fired the guy on the spot and carried on as you were. And I can imagine, I can think of some chefs straight off the head who I know would have done exactly that. But I think that says a lot of who you are and what your approach was.
Yeah, no, I think what it's done is it allowed me to hang on to people for a lot longer. And it's, you know, like Ashley, my business partner, he's been with me from his college days. So back in 2008, he started in the kitchen with me as a commis chef and worked his way up really fast. Then he did exactly what I did. He left a sous chef and took a job as a chef de partie, moved to London, did that for 4 years, then he came back. So he's been with me nearly 20 years, 18 years, and a lot of these other guys, I've worked them up from scullers, now they're head chefs, and, you know, Jules and the Beers. And I mean, I got such a dynamic team of people. And even some of the waiters and managers have worked with me for over a decade, you know. So if it wasn't for that conversation I had with that little commis chef, it may never have been turned out like this, you know. So I got to give him a lot of kudos.
We're going to track down his name and series. He's probably a chef now shouting at everybody in his own kitchen. We'll find out where he is. We fast forward now to where we find ourselves in South Africa. I think the last time we sat down in front of cameras, we had a great conversation about Wine and Beyond, which is still one of my favorite restaurants in South Africa.
Thanks.
And not just because it's got a great piece of artwork in your kitchen, courtesy of my daughter, but meals I've had at Fane, which are just extraordinary. I mean, I know will be extraordinary here today. You've got to this stage where I'd imagine 26-year-old Peter Tempelhof, starting off on his ninth different job to see if this one finally worked, probably even in an optimistic mood, wouldn't have imagined you would have got quite this far quite so quickly.
Yeah, you know, it did all start late. I started at 26, but it wasn't until when I was 48, that I started my first restaurant. So from 2018 till now, we've opened 6 restaurants. So that is quite, yeah, it's quite the progress in such a short space of time. Sometimes I wonder if it's not organic enough and we're opening too fast, because, you know, there's some things in the restaurants that aren't the way I want them to be. You know, some of the systems aren't in place yet, but, you know, nothing's perfect when you open it. It's a work in progress and always will be. Just like food, you can never reach perfection, excuse me, right away. It's always aiming to be perfect, although never accomplishing it, But I think it's the pursuit of perfection which drives me, and in the restaurant as well. We're not finished here yet, even though it's a beautiful space. It was good enough to open. It was beautiful to open, but there's still finishing touches that we need to do. So like every dish, I'll put a dish on the menu. I'll cook it for like 10 days, 11 days and tweak something, and I cook it for another 10 days and tweak something else. And it's, you know, then we're close to perfection after a month or two. So I like our, like the business we've grown into, we've developed. It's always a work in progress, and we're planning on growing it. So I'm not done yet. So there's some plans in the future. And I think when opportunity comes, you got to take it. And this is what we've done with Fane and with Beyond and with Aram. They're all great opportunities, working with amazing landlords. And it's, I've been very blessed and lucky to have this team around me so we can grow the company.
I've had, I think, three or four meals now at Fane. I'd eat there on a daily basis if my doctors would allow it, because it's a wonderfully indulgent space. Yeah. But it's also one that showcases such an important part of the personality of you as a chef, this myriad of influences that have come together to shape not just you the person, but also your philosophy and approach to the cooking. And there are touches of Asia, there are elements of Africa. I think of the Madagascan caviar that finds its way into the one of the dishes. Yeah. And for me, it's a fascinating portrait of a chef, almost wine we speak of terroir. This food is showcasing so much of who the chef is. How have you seen that evolution? How has the broader menu of Peter Templeoff come together through these life experiences that you've had?
Yeah, you know, I was quite lucky with Fane because I followed my heart on that one. Frank Zlomka, the chef at Bosman's, when I first started my internship, he'd cooked in Japan and Singapore, and he had a lot of these ingredients in the kitchen. So I was exposed to these Japanese, Asian ingredients from a very young age. And always they resonated with me because of their umami richness and their exoticness. And I've always loved that type of cuisine, that the lightness of it, I don't know how they get the flavor into their food, the Japanese, with such lightness. And that's what intrigued me about it. So I've always had like a Japanese dish in my menu along the way. And it wasn't until the opportunity of Fane came up, I said, no, I need to follow my heart on this one. I need to somehow join Japan and Africa and South Africa into a cuisine that's unique. And I think at the time, Cape Town and South Africa is ready for something like that. Or I think people loved it because it was so different. You know, I'm classically trained. I love French cuisine. I love Italian. You know, I was, trained by a German chef. But it was quite rich. A lot of reductive jus and a lot of heavy creams. And I wanted to go lighter. I wanted to go more flavorful. And it was blending the two was interesting because of, the South African ingredients. I didn't know how they're going to react to Japanese techniques. And I think it worked well. We just got lucky with that one. And the space as well, the space was unique. Because where it is, it shouldn't work. It's like in a top of a, in a kind of dodgier area of Cape Town, the east side of Cape Town. And when we opened, there's still, the streets were, not the best. They're safe, but.
And it's across the road from Parliament, so lots of very dodgy people.
Very dodgy people. So I took a fellow restaurateur up there, Mike Townsend, who had Harbour House and all those restaurants at the same time. And I said, Mike, just have a look at the space. What do you think? He said, I would not open a restaurant here if you gave it to me. He said, you're completely fucking mad. Do not do it.
So he was undecided.
So he was, he said, no, this will never work. And I think because we were quite daring with the food and we made it into a destination, that it worked. And then it was just, getting the right team on board. And I knew Jennifer Huget was looking, she was looking around. It was time for her to move on to her next thing after working at Le Colombe Group for 17 years. So, I just had a conversation with her, a casual conversation. I said, listen, we're doing something if you're keen. And then I chatted to Ashley, got him. He was about to, after running Greenhouse with me, he was also looking for the next thing. And he's a Japanophile by nature. He already had his body full of Japanese tattoos before he started Fane. So it's kind of like, it's just all the pieces kind of fell into place. And it was just the right time to do it. And then from there, because we did so well with it, we were able to, COVID came, that kind of screwed things up a little bit. After a year of opening, COVID came, we had to shut the doors up. But luckily we had a good year. We just had enough to squirrel through. And then Beyond came in the middle of COVID. It had shut down, the chef had left. And again, John Mathen said, "You're completely nuts. Why would you open a restaurant in COVID?" You know, so I think we're daring, you know, we're brave, and it's paid off.
It certainly has, and the accolades are not just local. You're one of the few restaurants in Fane that frequently features in that World's 50 Best list and the top 50, top 100, depending on the year. And that has come with a lot of interest and admiration from around the world. Does it at all change then how you operate, that now all of a sudden you're not just this great South African restaurant, but you are a destination for people from around the world who now see this as somewhere I must come and eat?
Yeah, it has changed the way we operate things. We like to think of Fane as a restaurant that you can pick up and put into any cosmopolitan city around the world, any first world country city. You can drop it into New York, you can drop it in London, and people would still find it really interesting just because the food is quite unique. And I tell all my staff, listen, please make sure when you do something, it's got to be world class. The service has to be world class. The food has to be world class. And if you don't know what it is, I will happily send you overseas so you can understand it. And I've done that with all my upper management. I've sent them overseas. I said, go eat, go check it out, go see what we're trying to accomplish here. I think all restaurateurs should aim for perfection. And most of them do. I know you'll never reach there, but aim for international perfection. I think that's what's working for us. You know, and also the details. You haven't been to the Fane's refurb. You haven't seen it recently.
I've been queuing online for the last 3 months. Very hard to get.
You got to know someone. Hey? So you'll see the refurb. When we open Fane, we open it on a budget. We open it for the same price as a Wimpy. So I begged, borrowed, stole. I got someone to make furniture with, you know, discounted rates, and I gave them shares for that, and they put that ceiling feature in for some shares. So sold some shares of the business. I opened the restaurant, managed to buy those shares back over the years. And, you know, we were missing a lot of things when we built it, you know, because of that. And we said, okay, this is a time to finish all the pieces that we wanted to, or finish the little bits and bobs. So we feel like it's nicely curated now. All the details are there. We've got handcrafted or handmade chopsticks now, as opposed to buying them from Japan before. So it's made out of African wood. We've got, you know, the tables you'll see when you go, but I don't want to give too much away. But the interiors are particularly special. And we managed to fix the acoustics because it used to be a bit of a glass dome where all it was noisy in there. So I had to pull that thing down and put an acoustic ceiling in, and we can finish it off. Now I think it's as close to perfect restaurant as I can do.
That is hard to envisage because it was already so perfect the last time I went. And I can say this not just because I thoroughly enjoyed it, but because the last time I had lunch with Joanne Strauss, and that was her weekly meal, because that's when Miss South Africa's eat. And she ate absolutely everything, which I've never seen happen before. But it comes across as not just a fabulous restaurant that speaks to all of these different influences, but also a real love letter to yourself in terms of who you are, what you've done, and what your career is all about.
Yeah, thanks. It is, excuse me, it is very different from the other restaurants. So when we opened Fane, it was this moody, dark space with this Japanese accent and this African bees. And I think the food suits the room. That's why it works so well. And when people come up and they enter the old building, they come up this lift, they don't know what to expect. When they come into Fane, they're like, wow, I can't believe this restaurant is on this old building in this old dodgy part of town. Beyond Aram, completely different restaurants. You'll see here, it's light, it's bright, it's got a farm feel. It's what we decided in the company is not to rubber stamp our restaurants, not to make them the same, not to make the food the same, not to make the menu the same. The price points are all different. This is harder to manage, you know, because we got average spends, which go from like 250 Rand to 3,000 Rand in each of the restaurants, and the sliding scale of that. So the last thing you wanted to do is to open up the same thing. So you'll see everyone is like part of my character, but a different side of my character. Like this is more my, you know, my continental European African. I don't know how to explain it, but you'll notice that they're all very different. And which is why I love the company that we've built together with my partners. Very unique.
Which makes me wonder about the one cooking space that we haven't mentioned. And I am thinking of this based on a dinner that you very kindly did once for myself and my family in the tail end of COVID. We were at Element House, where you've done so much work over the years. And you said you were just knocking together something very simple and proceeded to have a nine-course meal of galactic proportions. If I were to drop round to Chez Tempelhof, just come round to your home, is it also a nine-course Tuesday evening dinner you're just casually whipping up? What do you like to eat at home?
No, it's very, very different. We do a lot of casual stuff. I love – my wife's actually a great cook. She does a lot of brioches and slow-cooked foods, and she's actually opened my eyes to the way you can cook a stew very simply. So I would, when I start my stews, I get onions, I brown them and get flavorings, then chuck wine in there and tomato paste. Cause you know, it's the way the French do a coq au vin, or they do a beef bourguignon. And you cook it down, it's very rich. All she does is she bangs some onions into the pan. She browns them really, really well. Puts meat in, that doesn't even brown the meat, just puts the lamb knuckles in, covers it with a bit of water and boils the fuck out of it, right? Till it's tender. And then she'll chuck in some sago, right? Sago softened, and some veggies from the freezer, like some corn and peas. No herbs, no wine, none of that shit, not even garlic. And it's the most incredible stew because it's just so simple. You can taste the lamb, you don't taste wine, it doesn't take over. And she's actually told me, really keep it simple at home. And I even use that recipe now in the restaurants, and it's incredible. You know, so.
So really only one step on from putting frozen hake fillets directly into the oven, really.
I learned from the women in my life. But no, we just keep it simple. Sometimes we'll have burger night at home. We do try sit down around the table every night. That's important every night that I'm home. And last night it was roast chicken and sweet potatoes, which I think is one of the best meals in the world. That smell of the roast chicken, if you chuck a whole chicken in the oven with some veggies in it, there's nothing better than that. You just sit around the table with some salad and you got a beautiful meal with family. And then, we'll test new dishes like the sushi. So the sushiya, we've got some great sushi. We've got a great chef there. It's at the Taimao Market. And he's running a new menu, so we'll take him containers of sushi, and that's what we'll have one night. And then we're testing ramen, bring home some ramen broth, bring home some noodles, cook ramen at home, So a lot of this stuff does end up at my house, but my fridge is always full of veggies. It's always got pasta in the cupboard. It's always got some meat at some stage. Yeah. So, and a lot of fish.
I will be eating at Aram today. I've got Fane on the immediate horizon. As those of you listening to the show regularly all know, we've recently had Gagan and Chef Ton, Chef Pam, the brothers Suring on the show. Amazing meals I had in Bangkok. And yet, for me, right up there with those chefs, up there with Peter Tempelhof, up there with the best of anywhere I've eaten, is a Greek lady in her late 60s called Eleni, who just happens to be my mother-in-law, who makes food that I enjoy as much as any. And that's because she makes simple, old-school Greek Mediterranean food, normally catering for 12 people for everyone who's actually there. But it's a reminder that I don't think the chefs often need, but often those of us who eat need, that it doesn't have to be 92 ingredients and 17 courses, that ultimately the very best food comes down to a simplicity of thought and process.
Absolutely, and technique and ingredient. Most important thing is ingredient. You get exceptional ingredients, you can make great food. It's hard to do it the other way around. And then keep it as simple. I think a design, especially on a plate, is only perfect when you can take nothing more away from it. So we'll just be pulling garnish. Guys, don't put this garnish on. Don't put that on. Why is that there? Just keep taking things off, until you don't want to lose the essence of the thought process behind the dish. You don't want to lose that. But you don't need the frivolity of micro herbs and flowers and this and that to make it look nice. You got to be clever about your plating and clever about how you make it look nice with all that stuff. So that's how, you know, it's simple is better.
My parents-in-law have a garden in the Free State, and literally every meal has got something that's come out of the garden that very day. And there is just something so wonderful and wholesome
Absolutely,
about that.
Yeah.
The downside, of course, is that my mother-in-law does think I'm anorexic and thus feeds me relentlessly. But gee, it is very, very hard to say no. As it is to the great dishes, and before I let you return to your kitchen to not shout at your staff, but instead read them poems and massage shoulders, we can't do that anymore, but to sing Kumbaya and make sure that they all feel happy and loved and in a nice, warm and engaging space. Over the years, and maybe this is even before you were 26, I'm not sure what the answer will be, but of all the places you've traveled to, of all the spaces in which you have eaten, and there have been some formidable ones beyond just your very own, what is the single greatest dining experience that Peter Templehof has ever had?
Damn, Dan.
nice, easy question to wrap up with.
I know. I think that first one, the one that really cemented my career, that Raymond Blanc cooked for me, that has to be the greatest one for me, just because of how it imprinted in my mind. I can still remember all the dishes to this day. Another standout one has to be at a little restaurant in Tokyo, in Yotsuya. There was this restaurant where I went with Chef Makuni, who is a great Japanese chef. It was my first trip to Japan. Didn't know what to expect. So it was a little omakase restaurant that probably seats about 12. And the chef couldn't speak English. Makuni couldn't speak English. They brought this little chamushi, which I didn't know what it was at the time. And it was the greatest thing I've tasted. I'm like, what is this? And they couldn't tell me. He was behind the bar going like this, shark fin chamushi. So although I shouldn't rave and talk on the hilltops about shark fin, because I don't believe in that, in the way that the inhumaneness of it, I have to just say it was probably the best thing I've tasted in Japan. And that restaurant, I can't remember the name of it right now, was the greatest restaurant. I will get the name though, I promise.
All right, we need the name of that. We need the rare name of the brave junior chef who took you to
task.
Yeah,
I don't think we'll get to that
ago.
One, but I'll get the name of the restaurant.
All right, what we do need to
remember. I got it. It's Suzunari.
Suzunari.
Suzunari in Yotsuya, Tokyo. Oh, right. Yes.
Okay, straight to the top of my list, if it's still there.
It's still there. It's still got one Michelin star.
All right.
And I went there last time I went to. It was incredible. It wasn't like the first time because, you know, I was a virgin for that type of food, and it's only a virgin. You always remember the first one. So, but it was still brilliant, yeah.
All right. It is very firmly on my list. Say two, of course, is a return to Fane and a return to Beyond and a return to Ramen Head and my debut coming up at Arum. And then whatever is next, because you have cloak and daggerishly alluded to some more projects on the horizon. So whether it is a burger joint at a local casino or whatever you have on the cards, it'll be one that we'll be queuing up for, because I think one of the great marks of the success that you've had is that the moment the name Peter Templehof is attached to an establishment, we know we're going to be excited by the food, we know we're going to be rewarded by what you've poured into it, and we know it's going to be a comprehensive experience where the food is a big part of it, but not the only part. And I think that's a really, really nice hallmark of what you've created behind your name as a chef.
Thanks, Dan. I appreciate that. All in life's work, eh?
All right. So if you're out there, you're 26 years old, you're thinking, what should I be doing with my life? Surely something should have started by now. Maybe you're 38. Should I start a new business? Am I a little too late? 48. Should I be getting something going? Well, here is evidence. It is never too late to start. And in the case of Peter Templehof, a most extraordinary career, took a little time to get into first gear. It's now in eighth gear and climbing rapidly. And those of us who dine at his many restaurants are all the better for it.
You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.